Hello and welcome to the Scholar's Circle and the Insider's Insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how much does the president drive American foreign policy and how much is actually driven by other factors? Then, as the Republican primaries wind down, we'll look ahead to the potentially deciding issues of the presidential election in November. How much do presidents, and for that matter, presidential campaigns, affect American foreign policy? How much is driven by the military, the intelligence agencies, the bureaucracies, or interest group lobbies? What do presidents believe about the effect of their decisions? We have with us two experts. Jeremy Suri is professor of history and chair for leadership in global affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Among his books are Liberty's Surest Guardian, American Nation Building from the Founders to Obama, and American Foreign Relations Since 1898. James Boyce also joins us. He is professor of political science and director of the postgraduate program in international relations at Richmond, the American International University in London. His publications include JFK, The Exceptional Ideal, and The Policy Brief, Building Practical Skills in International Relations and Political Science. Jeremy Suri, you have been studying essentially the history of American foreign policy, particularly as it's tied to various administrations. And I wanted to get a sense, given the election that we're going into, how much presidential elections affect the direction of American foreign policy?
Presidential elections have a huge effect on American foreign policy because they mobilize people for positions that they might not be mobilized for otherwise, and they create rhetorical commitments that it's very difficult for candidates to move away from once they're in office. So if you make a rhetorical commitment, for example, that you're going to fight to protect people in foreign countries who are being oppressed, and then you don't do that when you're in office, it's very hard for you to explain your way out of that position. So they do have this way of shifting the policies of the country based on the rhetorical commitments that candidates make.
And you've looked at the presidents really from the founding to the present day and looked at how much each of these administrations have changed or not changed the direction of the U.S. What is the magnitude of the change when you look at over a historic time period like that?
Well, it's a great question. I think over time, the nature of the administration and the character of the person elected matter a lot. But it's always a mix of that and the circumstances, which might not change from one administration to another. So President Obama is a great example and fits the historical pattern. He has shifted American foreign policy, disengaging from Iraq, using more special operations than traditional military forces, encouraging diplomacy with Russia and other countries. But at the same time, he hasn't completely overturned what were some of the elements of the Bush administration's policies because the circumstances made that difficult. So it's a mix of the changes that come with personality, but the enduring elements of circumstance that don't change with personality.
How much do you think, from your historic standpoint, really has to do with the status quo of the bureaucratic elements, the standing military, the standing intelligence? How much does that drive the agenda that you can tell?
It does. Again, not in the obvious way of people in those agencies telling political leaders what to do, but the intelligence agencies, the military establishment and others, they have an agenda-setting role quite often. They help to define what are seen as the available options and what are not. And what often happens is an administration comes into office thinking it's going to do something different, and it's convinced by these agencies that it's harder to do that than it hopes. A great example of this is actually the administration of Lyndon Johnson that succeeded John F. Kennedy. Johnson wanted to do a number of things differently, but the established Cold War procedures and Cold War needs of containment limited his perceived options. It wasn't a conspiracy. It was more that members of the military and other parts of the bureaucracy have established ways of doing things, and it's very hard for a newcomer, a new president, to change their normal habits, normal ways of acting.
James Boyce, how do you see this?
Yeah, I think that one of the interesting things is that traditionally people love to speculate and talk about change and focus upon the great change. Whenever we think about the media and its coverage of elections, there's a great focus upon, well, what change will be introduced? There'll be a lot of discussion, for example, about, well, what would change if Barack Obama was not re-elected this coming November and, say, Mitt Romney was? What change would that implement? But as Jeremy was alluding to, there's more oftentimes a great deal of continuity, even between Republican and Democratic presidents who might not see eyeball to eyeball. I would add to Jeremy's good example, when he mentioned Lyndon Johnson, I think that you can go on to the following administration, which Jeremy's written a lot about with regard to Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon campaigned very much with regards to the war in Vietnam, and people would have thought that he would have attempted to get out of Vietnam very quickly and all but promised to, leading a lot of people to think he would be out in 6 months. And, of course, it actually managed to drag on for the entire duration of his first term in office. And I think you can see a parallel there with what Barack Obama has done. He inherited the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and again, many people thought he would have taken less time to get out of Iraq. But I think that, as Jeremy referenced, you know, the overwhelming power of bureaucracy, and also not wanting to really be seen to be rocking the boat internationally. I think presidents come in promising change and realize that it's very difficult to deliver upon that without potentially risking the standing of the United States on the world stage. And this is certainly something which I think Nixon made reference to with regards to the decision to pull out of Vietnam slowly rather than quickly.
When we look across American history, particularly modern history, to an untrained eye, an unhistoric eye, it might look like President Carter was the only modern president to really be more focused on human rights and less focused on, say, nation building or imperialism and that sort of a thing. Jeremy Suri, how do you see this as a historian?
Well, I think President Carter was one of the most focused on human rights, took human rights seriously both as political principles and as components of what he thought could be an effective foreign policy of spreading American interests by spreading American goodness. So it was not unrealistic and purely idealistic. It was also realistic in his eyes. But he wasn't the only president to think that way. Ronald Reagan, he was perhaps more militaristic, too militaristic for my taste, in the way he applied human rights. But he took human rights quite seriously, particularly in the Soviet bloc. And I think we have to say that President George W. Bush, at least in his own terms, believed he was fighting for human rights. The question often becomes, human rights for whom? And when choices have to be made between different groups, how does one choose? Again, Carter made different choices from Reagan and Bush, but I think they would all argue sincerely that human rights moved their foreign policy.
That's really very interesting to think about the idea of human rights, given the direction of Reagan or Bush and what most people would see as severe violations of human rights, particularly in the Central American wars, and then with the Bush administration going into Iraq the way it did. James Boyes?
It very much depends upon how one interprets human rights. Don't forget, George W. Bush, of course, was much criticized around the world for his efforts to export democracy. And I think in Bush's eyes, democracy equates to human rights, the idea of delivering freedom, democracy to those corners of the world which have yet to receive it. And I dare say that somewhere in Crawford, Texas right now, President Bush will be looking at what's happening in what we think of as the Arab Spring and thinking, well, this is partly due to me. And that has spread throughout that part of the world. And we can debate that, but that's certainly an argument that will be being put forward by supporters of the Bush administration. I think this goes all the way back, though. I mean, you think about what Woodrow Wilson talks about, how he's going to make the world safe for democracy in fighting World War One, and coming right back up to date to an administration that I've done a lot of work on, the Clinton administration, certainly tried to put human rights at the center of its foreign policy in its first term. You might recall that when it's dealings with China, for example, it basically said, if you want to maintain most favored nation status trading with the United States, we want to see movement with your human rights. And actually went to Beijing in his time in office and lectured the Chinese leadership on live television, accusing them of being on the wrong side of history. What Clinton found out, however, is that unfortunately the Chinese could afford to say, well, what are you going to do if we don't? And as Tony Lake told me in an interview I did with him a couple of years ago, very difficult to convince the Chinese to do something that they don't want to do. If you're the United States, the degree of leverage that America has over China is not perhaps what it once was. So whilst you can attempt to do these things, I think as Carter found out and as Clinton found out, It's not an idealist world. It's very much a realist world. And by trying to put these ideals out there, very often it's easy to come up short.
So it sounds like what you're saying is, given the shape of the world and the real politic of the world, human rights really has very little chance.
I don't know about little chance. I think it's I think there's a difference here between trying to strive to project and to convey to the world idealism, which is a wonderful thing. But unfortunately, as I'm sure Richard Nixon would say if he was here, or Dr. Kissinger, you know, we live in a real world, and sometimes the ideals have to take second place to American realistic expectations around the world.
Now, as we look forward and we look at all of the issues that the United States is going to be dealing with in terms of foreign policy, and we look at the candidates, the way they line up, starting with, say, Mitt Romney, who looks like he's going to be the Republican frontrunner and the candidate for the Republican Party, what do we think might the American direction with foreign policy be? Jeremy Suri, what would you project?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that would be the same regardless of who's elected, and a couple of things that could be very different. No matter who's elected, American forces are going to draw down in Afghanistan. And no matter who's elected, the United States is going to continue to use drones, and the United States is going to continue to trade heavily with China and try to work closely with China, and we're going to continue to try to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons. But what could be very different would be American policy toward Russia. Romney seems to want to take a much harder line with Russia. Obama, as we overheard on the microphone a few days ago, seems to want to engage more. I think the same is true with regard to the Arab Spring. I think Obama's taking a much more pragmatic view. I think Romney would be much more ideological, sound more like George W. Bush probably with regard to the Arab Spring. And I think with regard to the European Union, I think Obama is much more bullish on the importance of U.S. cooperation with the EU. Romney is much more unilateral. So it depends on the issue, I guess. But I think we'd see some continuities and some differences.
You mentioned Iran as one of them, and there had been some debate within the debates about what to do with Iran, and it sounded quite a bit like war thumping in the Republican debates. Jeremy Suri, do you think that if we get a Republican president, that war with Iran is inevitable?
No. No, I think that is a case where the rhetoric goes far beyond where the Republican candidates would go if in office. It doesn't mean a war won't happen, but because of the excellent point you asked about with regard to bureaucracy and standard operating procedures, that's a very strong reason not to want to go to war with Iran. The American military has studied this issue very carefully, and they recognize this is not a scenario they like. It's going to be very difficult to use an accurate strike to eliminate Iran's nuclear capability, and a war in the region will get very ugly very quickly. So even the military figures within the administration will be pushing very hard against an elected Republican to avoid war.
James Boyce, let's bring you back in. Let's take a look at the Middle East and the European Union. There you are in Europe. How do you see the Middle East policy shaping up, whether we get a Democrat or a Republican presidency? And how do you see relationship with the EU?
Well, I think that perhaps I can just also come in a little bit on your previous question, because I think that whoever is president come January of next year, you're going to see a great deal of continuity. I think what you're hearing from the Republicans is an awful lot of saber-rattling, because really, they've got very little else they can do. They can't obviously expect to replace Barack Obama by saying, yeah, elect us and we'll do exactly the same. They have to be putting up some sort of counterpoint, irrespective of what they would do when they came into office. And again, I think that Jeremy and I are in a complete agreement with regards to the degree to which, you know, the bureaucracy would be very influential with regards to this. So I think that irrespective of who the president is come next year, you're going to see a great deal of attempts to try and calm the situation in the Middle East in particular, to try to make sure that Israel walks a fine line, that America stands side by side with Israel but in an attempt to try to project a sense of unity to the wider world, I would suggest that there might be more of an effort to try to take a diplomatic approach if Barack Obama was to be re-elected, which I think most people in Europe expect him to be, not to suggest that Mitt Romney has no chance, but I think that the odds at the moment are certainly favoring a re-election for Barack Obama, and that he will continue to take his similar approach with regards to those nations which could be added to the Arab Spring, for example. I don't expect to see American force used, for example, with regards to Syria in any great degree. And I think that it very much is in the United States' interest to allow nations in the region and the European nations to take the lead, as we have done with regards to Libya, for example, if anything in Syria is to happen. I think that we see with regards to the European Union and the financial meltdown which is in place in certain countries such as Greece, an attempt by the United States to let the Europeans take the lead with regards to this. Whether that leads to Greece leaving the European Union, we will have to see. But that will certainly be a dominating factor in whoever administration takes power in January next year.
Now, neither of you really talked about North Korea. Do we see anything developing with regards to North Korea? Jeremy Suri.
I think James's points were right on target, and I think they would apply to North Korea as well. I think the United States has certain strong commitments in the region to preventing North Korea from developing nuclear capability, but the United States, as James said, for Europe, will also try to work closely with its allies in the region and take a leadership role, but not a unilateral role. So Japan in particular will be an important actor, as will China. And South Korea, of course, as well. So I think the real variable with regard to North Korea is what the North Koreans do. I think American policy is on a pretty set trajectory to continue to tighten the screws with its allies without going to war.
And what about Latin America?
In Latin America, I think it depends from country to country, but I do think one of the big consistencies is the greater attention the United States is giving to Brazil as a major actor in the region. But one of the big discontinuities is, as always, Cuba. I think Obama is moving toward normalization of relations with Cuba. I think he will try to do that in a second term. I think for obvious domestic electoral reasons, Republicans will probably stall on that. So if you're interested in Cuban policy, which of course affects much of the Caribbean, there could be quite a big difference there, I think, from one administration to the other.
James Boyce, I also wanted to turn just a bit to the political science aspect of these foreign policy developments. And we talked a bit about the bureaucratic element and the strength of that for continuity's sake, particularly in agenda setting. But lobbying groups have a very big influence as well. We saw, for example, the Irish-American lobby really push President Clinton towards the Northern Ireland peace agreement. And we also see a great deal of pressure from, for example, AIPAC with regards to Israel and Palestine policy. How do you see this playing out? Do we see any other kinds of ethnic lobbying groups having any power?
That's a great question. I think for a start that if Barack Obama is re-elected president, history would reveal that he will be trying to spend more of his time in office in a second term dealing with global issues than with domestic issues. I think he would say, well, I've got my healthcare reform through, and it would be fascinating to see what happens with the Supreme Court in the coming weeks with regard to their decision. But if we assume that that stays on the legislative books, I think that history will show that he'll try to spend more time abroad cementing his position as a global statesman, as most American presidents have sought to do. And that as a result of that, of course, his policies could come under more scrutiny by foreign policy lobby groups. We've seen in recent weeks the attention that he has had to pay to AIPAC, for example. Friends of mine who were actually at that conference, who were certainly no friends of Barack Obama, came away very, very impressed with his stance and basically felt that he'd done enough on that occasion to secure re-election. Well, I think that's a telling statement that Republicans believe that by basically courting the Israeli lobby, one can secure re-election. Read into that what you will, but certainly I think that he has striven to make sure that he's kept his guard up with regards to that element. I think that if we think about other organizations, it really is, if you start looking around the world and see where the hotspots are, we've talked about several of them already, I think that the Pacific Rim region is very much going to be vital, whoever the next president is. Jeremy and I have both spoken about, you know, Korea, for example, the role of China. We've seen Barack Obama's Pacific pivot, as it's been referred to over here, certainly, come into effect. It'll be interesting to see whether a Mitt Romney administration would continue that. I think that whoever the next president is, they're going to have major struggles in that part of the world, knowing quite how to deal with China, both from a security and an economic position, and making sure that America doesn't slip in the world rankings beneath a resurgent China. I certainly hope they do. I'm certainly not one of these Europeans who stand here with glee talking about a declining the United States. I think both the Pacific and the European rims require a strong United States, and I'm sure that it's in America's best interest for that to continue into what will almost certainly be, I'd imagine, an Obama second administration.
And speaking of American interests, I think that I'd like to end with a big picture issue, which, Jeremy Suri, you have asserted in your work, which is you suggest that America's grand strategy has really not been merely imperialism, and that it really has been a combination of efforts with regards to its foreign policy. How would you articulate that?
I would put it this way, and I think it's an important debate we need to have. I think American foreign policy has involved expansion, and it has involved self-interest, and it has at times involved the use of excessive, brutal violence. But I also think American foreign policy has consistently sought to spread a particular model of governance, and it has consistently sought to create a system of states, of nation states, rather than empires. The United States is formed as a reaction against empire. And so that means it's more complicated than saying the United States is imperialist or anti-imperialist. I say it's neither of those two. These categories are too simple. Instead, I think Americans have pursued a mix of these two, which has produced very mixed results. And one of the problems in our rhetoric at home is that we make this too simple. We too simply assert our goodness. The world is more complicated than that. But our critics overstate our badness. And what I'd like to see is a fairer debate and a debate about how we can accentuate the good parts of our foreign policy and avoid the dangerous pitfalls we often fall into by overstating our benevolence and understating the dangers that are built into our idealism as well.
James Boyce?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that far too often critics of the United States point to what they would call excessive American spending on the military. We in the United Kingdom, for example, many people on the left would suggest that America spends too much on its arms without realizing that we have benefited directly from that, and also mocking the United States for not having a national health service, whilst forgetting that, of course, that it was the United States finances that allowed Britain to have and pay for a national health service, and we've only just finished paying off that loan. So I think the rest of the world really needs to be thankful for the fact that it has chosen not to be an empire of the old-fashioned ilk, but rather perhaps a postmodern empire.
I think that's a good point. There is room for criticism, and there's room for positive learning, too, and that's why these discussions are so important. We need to avoid the categories and look more deeply into the ways in which we can learn from the good and the bad in our own past. That's why history is so important.
It's a perfect place to end. Thank you, James Boyce, Professor of Political Science at Richmond University of London, Jeremy Suri, Professor of History at the University of Texas. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for having us on.
When we come back, what issues and factors may determine our next president? Stay tuned.
Dear Mr. President, were you a lonely boy? Can you say no child is left behind? We're not dumb and we're not blind. They're all sitting in your cells while you pave the road to hell. What kind of father would take his own daughter's rights away? And what kind of father might hate his own daughter if she were gay?
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. As Mitt Romney shores up the Republican nomination to challenge President Obama for the position of Chief Executive of the United States, what will matter to voters as they make their final decision? Is it merely a referendum on the president's past 4 years with the economy, the wars, or health care? What other policies or information will matter this time around? And how much will be determined by who votes and who stays home? We're joined by three experts. Jan Lely is professor of political science and government at the American University in Washington, D.C., and the author of several books, including Strength in Numbers, The Political Mobilization of Racial and Ethnic Minorities, and Mass Media and Politics, A Social Science Perspective. Robert Smith is professor of political science at San Francisco State University. His books include Conservatism and Racism and Why in America They Are the Same, and Race, Class, and Culture, A Study in Afro-American Mass Opinion. Thomas Holbrook also joins us. He is professor of political science and government at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee and the author of Do Campaigns Matter? Why don't we start with big picture questions, voting behavior 101. Perhaps, Jan Lely, we should start with you because you've studied who votes. We know that who votes really has a big impact on the electoral outcome. So give us a sense of who does vote and what that impact is.
Most of what we know focuses on the demographics of turnout. At least that's been the large focus. And the really strong and consistent finding there is that people with higher levels of education and higher levels of income are more likely to vote than those with less. And that's been the dominant wisdom. And then we have, I think, if we add on to that, our other interests and demographics. There's some evidence in terms of changing patterns of turnout on the part of women who now vote more than men. And we have an increasing turnout since the 1970s of African Americans in presidential elections. And the age patterns have changed a bit since then. Traditionally, older individuals have voted more than younger individuals. Much of that pattern holds, though we saw a few changes in that in 2004 and 2008. So most of the discussion is on the demographics, with our interest in kind of the basic characteristics of the electorate. But some of Tom's work and other certain studies of local politics also, of course, focus on mobilization and what the parties and political organizations do to try to get people to vote, whether that's churches or voluntary associations or unions. The mobilization becomes important, that those demographic patterns aren't written in stone, if you will, but we can see variations depending on the election and campaign strategies.
And before we go to the mobilization question, you started to address how this has been changing over time. And I imagine that the changing demographics themselves with increased diversity are having an impact. But I also think people who study the candidate-centered politics and the emergence of Barack Obama has had an impact. A, because he is African-American, B, because of the language that he uses, and the whole youth movement that grew out of his candidacy. Jan Lely, let's start with you on that, and then let's get Robert Smith's take.
You know, I'd probably go on both sides of the fence on that one. Obama was certainly had a very clear campaign strategy oriented toward youth, using some new technologies and perhaps new language. And we did see higher turnout in 2004 and 8 than we had since about 72 in the presidential election. So something was certainly different in 2004 and 2008. And I would suspect that much of that had to do with the resources he used as well as the strategies to try to get groups that don't typically vote to get them to the polls instead. So I think that's true, but not all the demographic changes, I think, have really translated to huge changes, I think, over time. We have the higher turnout. I think it's rather tentative, though, and dependent on the nature of the campaign and the election as to who's going to vote more. So we can have some variations around kind of the typical things, but that's dependent an awful lot on candidates and campaigns.
Robert Smith.
Well, with respect to African Americans, the Obama phenomenon, as it has been referred to, had a direct effect on increasing African American mobilization, the mobilization of the African American vote in 2008, and the turnout, which almost equaled, for the first time in American history, African-American turnout almost equaled the turnout of whites. And that in some sense is quite extraordinary. It says middle-class persons, middle-income, educated persons tend to vote at a much higher rate than low-income persons. And given the large segment of the black population that is low-income, to have a turnout rate that almost matches the majority population was in and of itself quite extraordinary. And then you had not only increase in turnout in terms of voting on election day, but in some areas black participation in that election actually exceeded whites in terms of attention being paid to the campaign, in terms of volunteering to work in the campaign, in terms of campaign contributions. So that was an extraordinary mobilization in the African-American community to elect the first person with a realistic chance, first black person with a realistic chance to become president. He was not just the first black person with a realistic chance to become president. If Colin Powell, for example, had decided to run earlier and had been nominated by one of the major parties, or if he had ran as an independent, I don't think you'd have saw the kind of mobilization and turnout for a Colin Powell that you saw for Barack Obama. It was not just being the first black person with a chance to become president, but the person who resonated well with the culture and ideological and political inclinations of the black community. A talented, handsome, young, and progressive, liberal black, I think, generated that kind of turnout. Now, we can talk a little bit later, perhaps, about whether or not that can be duplicated in 2012. But certainly in 2008, it was really an extraordinary phenomenon in the black community around the Obama candidacy.
I absolutely want to talk about whether or not that can be duplicated in the next round. Let's bring in Thomas Holbrook. Thomas Holbrook, let's talk about the effect of campaigns. This is apparently one of the more extraordinary ones and unique. Give us your overall sense of the effect of campaigns versus other national issues of the day that have a large impact.
Well, you know, the way I like to think about it is campaigns can affect voters in two different ways. One is a sort of persuasion effect, you know, convince voters who they should vote for. But the other is what we've been talking about, and that is sort of turnout and mobilization. And in terms of the persuasion side, I think that we tend to often sort of overestimate the potential for campaigns to change voters' minds. Really, if you look across the last 50 years of presidential elections, it's pretty hard to point at a presidential election and say, it's very clear that this election turned out the way it did because of the campaign. In most cases, you can look and say that the overriding political and economic context of the election favored one side or the other. And I think if we go back to 2008, I agree with everything Robert was saying about the Obama campaign and mobilization of African Americans. But at the same time, if you look at 2008 and what was going on in the country at the time, you know, an incumbent Republican president with, 35% approval rating, the economy really going in the tank in the fall of the election year. I like to ask my students, what was it that John McCain was supposed to do to win that election? I mean, what was the campaign that would have won that election? And it's really hard to figure that out. And I think that if you think about it in those terms, you realize that what we sort of, as spectators, get all involved in and sort of, even myself, you know, I study these things and I understand the limits, but I find myself almost, you know, during the general election campaign assigning all sorts of importance to things that probably in the long run aren't going to matter, assuming that both sides, you know, run effective campaigns, exploit the issues that are to their advantage, and so on. But I think, you know, we have to view the persuasive effects of campaigns within the context of whatever the national environment is right now. And in 2012, it's actually, you know, it's kind of a close call. This could be one of those years where the national environment isn't heavily favoring one side or another. I think a year ago, most people probably would have said, well, this thing is you know, perfectly set up for the Republicans to win. And now I think people are starting to think, with the economy turning around and Obama's approval rating inching up around 50%, that it's going to be a much closer race. And in that context, with a much closer race, I think we might be more justified in saying that what goes on in the campaign is really going to make a difference here. But I do want to get back to the mobilization issue, because I think that's where the campaigns can be very, very important. I think, you know, if I just go back to what Robert said about mobilization of African Americans, when you look at states like North Carolina, Virginia, and Indiana, and I think that if you look at the turnout rate among black voters in those areas, I think probably those are three areas where they're much higher than they ever have been historically. And those are three states that you don't normally think of a Democrat winning. So I think that's an area, a case where we can think about the mobilization of a particular group having an impact on those state-level outcomes.
One of the issues that you have researched is these national conditions, and what you mentioned, of course, now is the economy being one of the big ones, and I know a lot of political scientists look at economic voting as one of the primary issues that people will cast their vote on, and there's the argument about whether it's their own pocketbook or whether it's the national economy. Given the mixed economy, it's starting to come back. There are still huge numbers of people that are not doing so well. How much that's going to play in with other factors? You get a sense of other national issues that might come in.
Well, you know, that's a good question, because I think that a year ago, the big issue in the election was going to be the economy because of the negative side. So as you say, things are turning around now. They're increasingly positive. But I don't think we're going to be at this sort of roaring economic state where the economy becomes a primary role in the campaign and is really to Obama's benefit. I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't know that that people are going to focus a lot on the economy, because from Obama's perspective, yeah, things are getting better, but you know, he's still going to be looking at, well, I don't know, by fall, maybe 7.8, 7.9% unemployment, which is much better than it had been. But I don't think he wants to spend a lot of time talking about that. And Romney, on the other hand, I think if he talks about the economy, it sort of brings up the fact that it has been getting better. So I guess the question is, sort of, what will the big national issue be then? And I'm not sure. I mean, I think that this is sort of starting to set up in a way that it could become an issue. It could become a campaign from the Democrats' perspective about character. And that is, you know, the primary season is kind of softening Mitt Romney up on this flip-flop type of character issue. And I think it's possible that you could see a campaign directed more at character this year than at, you know, any sort of the global issues like the economy.
Jan Lely, let's bring you back in terms of issues, in terms of ethnicity, race, gender. We've been hearing a lot from the left about a war on women. Will that resonate? Are there other things that are resonating with voting blocks within ethnic groups and racial groups?
The main issue of interest along those lines is with Latinos and Hispanics. But there isn't much of a competition, the issue being immigration. And, you know, there the Republicans just simply are not offering Latino. As much as they may say that they're trying to mobilize Latinos and get this increasingly large part of the population in their camp, the policy positions that many, especially outspoken Republicans, are taking on immigration are simply inconsistent with the personal interests and the values of the Latino electorate. So I think the Republicans are not going to want to talk. I don't know that anyone will want to talk about immigration as an alternative issue. That is, I think, an issue that can get Latinos out in terms of in the streets, writing letters, engaged. But I don't think that the campaigns, so there's not much that will interest them in talking about the issue. It's a difficult issue, and the logistics are hard to address in Congress to do anything. So I think Latinos are kind of trapped with the Democratic Party that they aren't that happy about. So if they don't see that there's a choice between a Republican and Democratic candidate, you know, they'll either stay home or stick with the party that is a bit closer to their positions. The Latino turnout is lagging behind both African Americans and Anglos. That turnout level is very low in presidential elections, all other factors considered. So for Latinos, no. In terms of the other groups, we have women voting more than men, all other education income aside. I don't see that that's going to be an issue that they're going to play into the election. So I'd probably go with Tom's assessment there that there could be a character issue. There could be, you know, a broader issue, perhaps an effort to talk about that country we want to be, the future we want to be, would be a little bit of a variation from that. But My sense is whatever the demographics or politically relevant groups, you know, our country has just been through a 3 or 4 year roller coaster ride, an economic implosion unheard of, you know, for at least 40 years. And I think voters are having a difficult time, other than being angry at everyone, are having a difficult time sorting out how they use that information.
Robert Smith.
I think probably ultimately the direction of the economy after the summer, or during the summer, or at the beginning of the summer, probably will likely be the key determinant of the outcome. But I expect this to be not a character election. I expect this to be an ideological election. The Romney-Ryan budget, as the Democrats have begun to refer to it, actually calls for a substantial reversal of the role of the government in assuring the well-being of ordinary people in terms of Medicare, Medicaid, and I suspect talk about partial privatization of Social Security. This is an effort on the Republican Party to halt and begin to roll back the New Deal, Great Society, social welfare programs. And they put that on the table in the form of this Ryan budget, which Romney has embraced. And I expect they will argue that this is good. That is, Republicans will argue this vast extension of the role of the government was inappropriate in terms of American tradition, inappropriate in terms of our capacity to finance it. And I expect Obama to try to draw that line and have an argument, really, about the role and size of the government in almost stark ideological terms. Do you want to reduce the role, size, and spending of the government, or do you want to maintain it, increase it, rationalize it, make it more efficient, but keep it on this path? I think the election will be shaped by ideology in that sense more so than character, and more so than by any of the other kind of peripheral issues that might enter, like, for example, even the wars in Afghanistan or Iraq, the past war in Iraq.
We've got a couple of things here. We've got an ideological split. We've got a character split. I want to go back to those. I want to also look back at the mobilization issue, because it seems like who votes really does matter, and it ultimately does have a large impact on what the outcome is. Now, given in the past that Barack Obama was able to mobilize particular groups, blocks that normally would not vote, as those high rates, I wonder if we can look at the mobilization efforts and the demobilization efforts of each side. It seems like part of the efforts of one side or the other is to suppress or depress voter turnout in certain areas while increasing voters in other areas. So if we could start with Jan Lely, you looked at labor and how labor has an impact. Now, labor has shrunk considerably in terms of how it represents people, but where they come in, you found that there's an impact.
That's right. Now, but it's important that to remember, it's not just that, you know, the unionized percentage of the workforce has shrunk, but the unionized percentage of the workforce has also changed in terms of the type of groups that the unions are representing. And that is a bit of a challenge for the unions. And, you know, they're no longer represented. They're representing different types of workers, such as service workers. And I think that makes it in some states and localities, it makes it a little difficult to mount a strong partisan opposition to certain policies. Do they have the resources? Yes. Will it work the same as in the days when that unionized workforce translated to only teachers and auto workers and, you know, other blue-collar workers? We have a lot of professional workers represented, and I know I've heard union organizers say that's a bit of a challenge. It makes their political operation, they have to be a little more careful. Now, and Tom, I'm sure, knows more about this than I do, you know, with what has happened in Wisconsin, right? There we have unions working against the governor. Maybe there is, you know, that will have some spillover effects. So surely nationwide, the extent to which the unions engage, and I think this goes back to Robert's comment about the ideological nature of the campaign, if the rhetoric is you know, and Perry hasn't survived, but if the rhetoric of Perry is we want to make Washington irrelevant to your lives, we want to eliminate government from your lives, you know, that very strong ideological claim, I think, you know, the unions can react against to some degree, and it becomes an ideological distinction. But I think the unions have to be careful. They're smaller. They have some resources, but certainly there's big money coming from all directions at this point.
Thomas Holbrook, let's have you talk about mobilization and demobilization. And with regards to the character issue, we've had some various psychological scholars and neurological scholars on here who talk about one of the ways of demobilizing and mobilizing is to paint one candidate or the other as this really awful person that's destructive and evil. Does this work?
Well, I don't think we know. I mean, there have been some political science studies that sort of suggest that, you know, sort of, you know, creating increased anxiety in people about candidates or about political situations might sort of force them to pay more attention, but doesn't necessarily get them out to vote. Whereas if you can generate enthusiasm about your candidate, that's more likely to get your partisans out to vote. But in my view, those findings are kind of tenuous. In the real world of politics, when we're actually looking at political messages and trying to get a sense of what impact they have, I just think it's really kind of hard. I mean, let me say, it's hard enough to even tell if advertising itself has much of an impact, let alone if the specific messages of advertising have much of an impact. Once you get outside the laboratory and out into the real political world, there are just so many variables, so many things happening, that I'd be hesitant to say that I'm convinced that demonizing a candidate will necessarily demobilize their supporters. I mean, it's not a bad idea to try to get people, you know, to not vote for that person, but I'd be a little hesitant to say the research really falls down squarely on one side of that issue.
And other efforts towards mobilizing and demobilizing.
You know, I think mobilization, I think it's, I mean, increasingly, I think what we're seeing is it's a physical task. It's going, knocking on doors, contacting people, putting together lists, you know, contacting those people on or near Election Day. And I think that's really sort of what mobilization is about. It's money, and it's a physical task. I think that I think the last two, maybe even three presidential elections, the parties and candidate organizations have really sort of realized that, yes, they need to advertise, they need to spend money getting the message out. But I think they're really sort of doubling down on mobilization and not just trying to increase turnout, but increase turnout among people who are likely to support them. And, you know, and Jan was talking about unions. There are other groups who try to do this as well. You know, unions, interest groups, you know, groups aligned with the parties or candidates. But I think that in terms of mobilization, it is that real physical and sort of money-based effort on the part of the parties. And I think, you know, again, you know, that sometimes it's like pushing a string and you can't get certain people or certain groups or, you know, certain types of people out to vote, but those are also frequently people who are unaligned and parties are unlikely to be trying to get them out to vote anyway. So I'm not sure that mobilization has a great effect on the overall turnout level so much as maybe the complexion of the turnout. Again, maybe setting aside the African-American turnout in 2008, which was really, I think, a special circumstance of the candidate and the group. But I think that if you look at where there are greater mobilization efforts on part of one party versus the other, I think you can see that reflected in the political complexion of the electorate in that particular election year.
Robert Smith, you started to hint at your thoughts on whether Obama's presidency would reinvigorate those voting blocks.
Well, I initially thought not, that the first time around, the historic nature of the first election would be a kind of unique situation. But my guess is this upcoming election will be much more racialized than the last. McCain, to his credit to some extent, declined to overtly racialize the campaign. I don't think that will be the case this time. I think either the Romney campaign directly or various surrogate groups will explicitly racialize the campaign. And I also think they're likely, the Romney campaign directly or surrogate groups, will talk about Obama in a way that African Americans broadly review as an effort to demonize him, to put him outside of the mainstream of American society. And I think if that is done, then that is likely to have a mobilizing effect on the African American community. There's disenchantment with Obama at various levels of the African American community for various reasons. But I think if he is portrayed in a way that blacks view as unfair and is racially negative, that possibly could be a mobilizing force this time around in a way that might have those rates of participation be equivalent to what they were in 2008.
So,
could I jump in here?
Yes, please.
Yeah, I think Robert's exactly right, and I think probably, unfortunately, on both of his comments, I think he's unfortunately probably right that race will be much more front and center this time around. I think assuming Romney's a nominee, he's shown no compunction about just going after his opponents, and it's clearly become, you know, on the right, the Obama as other has clearly become, you know, the sort of the dominant theme. And I think he's also right that this will serve to mobilize African American voters more than they normally would be. But I think also it's going to backfire among a large share of the white electorate, too. I mean, people who think of Obama as the other already do. And I think there are a lot of voters, certainly people with sort of liberal racial views, who admittedly are likely to vote for him anyway. But I think a lot of people sort of in the middle will be turned off by that.
Tom Holbrook, you've written about information factors and the kinds of information that is meaningful to voters. And it seems voters do not really keep up that much with policies, per se. What is the information that is meaningful? Is it really this divisive, polarizing campaign rhetoric that works? Or is there really thoughtful, rational information that has resonance with voters?
Well, thoughtful, rational information. I'm going to go with the heated campaign rhetoric on that one. You know, campaigns know that they've got to boil their messages down and sort of make it simple and use buzzwords, phrases, campaign themes that really serve as kind of a heuristic for voters and really say a lot more. For instance, we're just talking about race, okay? You know, Romney and the Romney campaign, they're not going to come out and talk openly about race, but they'll use these racial code words to talk about race and to try to activate race as a consideration among voters. You know, I think anything they can do to sort of remind the electorate that Obama isn't like the, you know, most of the rest of us. And so it's those sort of code words and buzzwords that are going to resonate most easily. You know, voters on average, you know, we kind of forget this. I mean, you've got a nice radio program. We all teach political science. And we kind of forget what political life is like for the average person. And, you know, I suppose it's like, you know, baseball season is for people who aren't really into baseball, but it's there. So the average voter doesn't pay a lot of attention and doesn't pick up a lot of sort of detailed, what you just referred to, sort of rational, sort of thoughtful information. You know, unfortunately, there's this idea that we refer to as the knowledge gap. And essentially what it says is if you start at the beginning of a public information campaign, I think this stuff started back in the 60s with sort of like anti-smoking campaigns and things like that, that the people who get the message, who get the information, are the people who need it the least. And political campaigns are like that as well. If you look at over the course of the campaign, you know, groups of people by education and how much specific information they have about candidates, people with a high level of education start the campaign with more information and gain more information during the campaign than people with low levels of education. So the sort of gap between the information haves and have-nots actually tends to grow during the course of the campaign. But I'm talking there about these very specific, concrete sort of policy or personal characteristics that we can ask people about, sort of political facts. But still, by the end of the campaign, you know, I think most people who are going to vote, They can tell you which candidate is more liberal on any given issue. They may not know what the issue position is, but they'll have a sense of who's the more liberal candidate or who's the Democratic candidate, who's the Republican candidate. And really, you know, unless there's some single issue that's really that really matters a lot to a voter, that could be enough for them to make, you know, what is a reasonably sort of what some people call a gut-level or rational decision.
Jan Lely, you get the last word.
Yes. I think Tom's point of those of us who are interested in politics, we pay attention to it in different ways. We're exposed to it in different ways. And to think that it's easy to overestimate for the typical voter or citizen the extent to which these issues mobilize. It's a pastime of secondary interest at best. And so I think to assume, as Tom suggests, as much as the campaigns try, they're going to have to keep it simple and consistent, and then flip a coin.
It's kind of a sad state of Democratic participation in America.
I don't know that I would conclude that.
I want to thank all three of you very much for spending your time with us.
Great. Thank you.
I've had fun.
Enjoyed it. Thanks.
Jan Lely is professor of political science and government at the American University in Washington, D.C., and the author of several books, including Strength in Numbers, The Political Mobilization of Racial and Ethnic Minorities. Robert Smith is professor of political science at San Francisco State University. His books include Conservatism and Racism and Why in America They Are the Same. Thomas Holbrook is professor of political science and government at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee and the author of Do Campaigns Matter? And that's it for today's show. Thanks to all of our guests and to Ankina Alhassian and Ishmael Karim, who helped produce this show. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed any part of the show, you can go to kpfk.org and click on the archives. You can also keep up with us at armoodian.com or scholarcircle.org. And you can follow me on Twitter at armoodian.